Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winder Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman, and I'm here with my co-host, Lara Chan Baker.
Hello.
Hello. Here at Jackie Winder, our roles put us right in the center of the action, in between client and creative, so we get to see all sides of the process. Every week, we come together in the ATM vestibule that is our recording studio and dissect three different links we've come across during our recent internet travels. We use these as a jumping off point to look at what's shaping the issues, processes, happenings, and ideas across the creative industries today. This week, we are going through our open tabs and we'll be discussing how to live like a genius, the next big thing in VR, and regaining power in our tech-dependent age. Helping us bring some outside perspective today is our special guest, Carla McRae. Carla is a mightily talented Melbourne-based illustrator. We first met Carla when she actually interned here at our gallery, Lamington Drive, and since then she's continued to develop her practice, taking things to enormous heights, and we're unbelievably proud to represent her on the JW roster.
That's so nice.
Her works pull together a blank space with clean lines, geometric shapes, and strong color. They're simple, honest images inspired by the beauty of everyday moments and simple pleasures. And actually, she has a show running right now in our gallery in Collingwood that will be up until February. Do we know the exact date? Sometime in February. At least in time when you hear this podcast, this will see it.
January 26th.
January 26th.
Thank you, Carla.
February adjacent. So if you're in Melbourne, make sure you come down and have a look. Carla also worked as the creative director for Australian sock company Odd Pairs, designing socks, giving the brand its distinctly designed vibe from 2013 until 17. And also has a huge range of clients. I'm not going to list them all here. You've got all the major players covered. You got your Sonos, you got your Apple, you got your Pentagram, you got the Royal Children's Hospital, you got Frankie Magazine, you got pretty much everything. So I'm realizing now
I forgot to edit that list for you, Jeremy.
It's a very long list.
I got distracted.
That was a generous introduction. Thank you.
Carla, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We're so excited. I mean, it's always nice for us when you drop past, but to have you here, not just dropping past to say hello, but to actually record with us is very, very lovely.
It's good to be in the hot box. Yeah.
And it really is today because it's 37 degrees in Melbourne, and whatever temperature it is like outside, it's at least 5 degrees hotter in here. So thank you.
Petuta summed it up adequately, saying that, like, you know, the January heat wave that everyone expects every year always takes us by surprise. You know,
absolutely.
It's so true. But it's like the Australian Open's always around at the same time as well.
I don't know how they do it.
And people go. I don't understand either.
And we've been out painting a mural today, and I'm slightly worried that the artist might die.
Oh my God. Anyway. We're going to get stuck straight into it. Lara, your first link, naked, drunk, and very tired, also describing us right in the studio right now, but also this article. Take us through this link.
Yeah, so... Great intro. We have all seen the countless articles, if you want to be successful, you have to wake up at 3 a.m. or Steve Jobs never ate breakfast and you shouldn't either, et cetera, et cetera. And this week I've got an article that I found on Medium by a guy, Eric Spitznagel. He's a writer for all sorts of other publications. And he put a bunch of these random claims to the test. It's titled, as he said, Naked, Drunk, and Very Tired, What I Learned from Trying to Live Like a Genius. So to set the scene, I want to read the opening paragraphs. Eric begins, "It's 6 o'clock in the morning and my privates are the temperature and color of a blue raspberry snow cone. I'm sitting on a deck chair on my open air back porch, which overlooks an alley and half a dozen houses. It's November in Chicago and the weather is a nippy 24 degrees. I don't know what that is in Celsius, but cold. On any other day, I wouldn't even consider walking outside without a down jacket and mittens, or at the very least, pants. But today, I'm wearing shoes, just shoes. I cross my legs in case a neighbor happens to glance out the window. The wind is slicing into my frightened, exposed flesh. I've only been sitting out here for 20 minutes, but hypothermia feels like a very real possibility. I try to distract myself with my notebook and pen. I'm not just a masochistic nudist wondering how quickly genital frostbite sets in. I'm here with a mission. I'm trying to find out if acting like Benjamin Franklin can make me think like Benjamin Franklin." Anyway, so it goes on to explain that Benjamin Franklin insisted that being naked and cold helped his productivity, that he actually used to begin each day sitting in the nude next to his open first floor window, writing down his thoughts. And of course, you know, old mate Ben Franklin wasn't/isn't the only sort of brilliant mind to employ some very bizarre work habits. And the internet is home to many, many articles that try to take these habits of these wildly successful people and turn them into some sort of instructional for the everyman. me being the everyman here, the writer, he took some of the wilder of these and actually gave them a go. And for each of the 10 tactics that he tried out, he sort of outlines which creative genius was into it, how his personal testing went, and the science or lack thereof to back it up. So another tactic he tried was writing in bed, which was favored by Truman Capote, René Descartes, James Joyce, Voltaire, Proust, Churchill, to name just a few. Eric's experience was quite amusing. He writes, "I climbed into bed dressed in a suit and tie so I wouldn't forget that I was there to work. Instead, I felt like the main attraction at a wake," which I imagine would be how you would feel. He also tried sleep deprivation, which didn't go so well for him. He recounts, 48 hours of sleeping in 20-minute spurts didn't make me more alert and creative, just more unhinged and emotional. I cried at everything, dropping my kid off at school, kind emails from colleagues, Google commercials, with the kind of epic weeping usually reserved for a parent's funeral. He also tried celibacy, drinking, taking frequent showers, and a bunch of others. I don't think he did all of those at the same time. It is a funny read. It's far better than most of the banal posts about this stuff, and it definitely errs more on the side of entertainment than actual advice. But I did want to chat to you guys about the idea behind it. I personally often take issues with articles and books that try to simplify success to something like getting up at a certain time or drinking green smoothies, when I think, you know, of course, it's a massive combination of things like upbringing, personality, economic position, location, luck, etc., as well as those small individual behaviors. But of course, I mean, there must be some things that do actually help increase productivity or creativity in some people. And so, Carla, I want to know, how do you feel about these books and articles in general? And do you think that there is something that can be learned from the practices of successful people?
I'm in two minds about it. I'm open to it, but I'm also a little bit lazy about it because I feel like I also have my own systems that I've sort of developed over the years of working and like worked certain grooves into my work day that I feel have taken not just like, you know, the average 30 days of doing something until it becomes, you know, like a, what is that 30 day?
Habit. I think it's a, yeah, it's get a habit. Habit.
Yeah. The habit. So, and I know that they work for me. Yeah. But they may not be the best things, but I know that they work for me and I know that I can rely on them to get into, I don't know, the state of mind to work. I read the other day that the philosopher Kant would take a walk at 3:30 every single day without fail. And he'd do that every day because
in
it
the
was
afternoon,
the
way, not in, the morning,
in,
right?
In the afternoon, yeah. It was his way to generate his most potent ideas, I guess. Mm. And I love the idea of going for a walk at 3:30 p.m. on the dot every afternoon, but I just know that I would never be able to pull myself away from the desk consistently.
Yeah.
Like that.
And I mean, movement does definitely help. Like for me anyway, yeah. I'm quite a, what do they call it? Kinesthetic, I don't know what
that's good.
Word is.
That's good.
Something starting with a K. Learner or a thinker in that, like I always found, like I had a teacher in high school that recognized that and they would let me, because often they, you know, sit in your seat, stay in your seat, but they recognized that I often needed to kind of get up and walk to the bin or get up and get a glass of water, and I would work a lot better if I had, if I was able to do that.
Yeah. It's like when you get up to go to the toilet and you,
your brain starts working again, like the cogs start moving, like you've got to keep a watch moving to keep the cogs moving. Yeah, totally. I wonder if we should have taken a different angle with this podcast and instead done like, this is what Carla McRae does and you should do it too.
Well, I know, I was going to say, I entered this article skeptical. I thought, oh, like this is going to be exactly what you said. Yeah. There's so many articles like this. But I actually found that I do some of the things on that list.
Which ones?
And like I do rely on them for my productivity.
Oh my God, what so, are you doing? Not the cold and naked one, please.
Not the cold and naked one, not the celibacy one either. I guess I worked from home for quite a few years before I managed to work up to the point to get a studio. And when I worked from home, I also worked from my bedroom. Mm. And so because I was working in such a close, confined space, I really relied on forming these kind of habits and rituals to make these workarounds and find a way to stay focused and productive during the day and not leave the house. But for me, one of the things that the writer says is that Beethoven would take breaks to dunk his head in ice cold water.
Are you doing this?
I'm not dunking my head in ice cold water, but I do take like reset showers. When I start to feel stuck, I don't know, I'm feeling a bit restless and like I need to jog my mind a bit, or like I feel like I almost need to start the day again. Yeah. I'll just get up and get in the shower.
Do
and
you know about the mammalian diving reflex?
Tell us more, Jeremy, please.
This is a crazy thing. So it's a diving reflex, also known as a diving response, mammalian diving resets. It's a set of physiological responses to immersion that overrides the basic homeostatic reflexes and found in all air-breathing vertebrates studied today. And this is one of the things I tried when I was...
I'm an air-breathing vertebrate.
This is one of the things I tried when I was having this insomnia bout, because like I found like, you know, I was having just I couldn't kind of calm down at night. Mm. And so I was like looking at all these different things. And apparently you can generate this diving reflex by putting your head in a sink filled with cold water. And that automatically brings up this reflex that kind of slows your heart rate down because your body is like,
and
just,
did you do it?
I did it once. Yeah.
Did it work?
It worked, but I also got really wet. And so
that'll happen.
I think a shower is probably a better option.
So. Yeah. Then you're prepared to get wet. Jeremy, I want to hear, like, I mean, what about you? Because you do have weird habits. And also, like, for example, you talked to the wonderful Madeline Dore, who has her Extraordinary Routines blog, where she sort of documents the routines of various interesting people. And you sort of were one of those on there. And you are a man of habit, a man of routine. Do you have things that you do that you feel do contribute to your productivity or creativity that aren't just the standard, like, I manage my time?
I mean, I don't know. Like, I don't know if I do in kind of that kind of whole self-improvement way. And like, that's why, you know, pieces like this are kind of really, well, obviously, yes, this piece is kind of has entertainment value, but it is kind of a bit of a reflection on our huge culture of kind of self-improvement and all these kind of listicles of kind of things to try and kind of self-hacking and all that stuff, which is, I think is difficult. I kind of feel that like, well, all these kind of quirks that other people kind of have, they're really very kind of personal responses to things that just kind of are inbuilt or kind of beyond people's kind of control kind of in that way.
Or very specific to their environment.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. And I think, you know, the most highlighted piece in this article says the key is to put yourself in a space that shifts your thinking. Mm. And I think that's kind of a really hard thing to do. Like with so much kind of coming at you right now, I think everyone's kind of thinking is all fucked up at the moment, you know? So yeah, getting to shift your thinking is a great thing. But I think for me, yeah, like I've always been an inherently lazy person in kind of some ways, and so I use kind of habits.
That's insane to me, or anyone who knows you thinking of you as a lazy person.
No, I think, you know, there's like that famous Bill Gates quotes where, like, you know, he says like he likes to hire kind of lazy people because they're always going to find the most efficient way to do things.
Yeah,
like,
actually, yeah. That's true. All right.
So it's like, I think, you know, laziness, like, you know, like, yeah, good managers are inherently kind of lazy because usually they know how to hire people, right, to do the things that they can.
I am an exceptional employee then.
Exactly. But yeah, like for me, for example, like, you know, you mentioned the green smoothie thing. And so it's like, yeah, like I, like, you know, never was good with vegetables. And, you know, I've been having green smoothies for like 4 or 5, maybe even 6 years now. And, you know, has definitely had effects kind of on my health. And it's basically, yeah, it's getting me to do something I kind of didn't want to do in a way that's kind of unique to me. And that kind of makes sense. So yeah, that's definitely kind of one thing.
Well, you also look to not just, I mean, there's all the stuff, the individuals, Steve Jobs wore the same clothes every day, blah, blah, blah. But there's also, like, I mean, you spend a lot of time looking to companies that you admire and their processes and their practices, which I imagine to some extent are also personal to them, specific to them. But can you look at how you can apply those things in other ways? And I feel like you're often talking about within the company how we can take things from the way, I don't know, maybe Basecamp runs or maybe someone else runs things and whether we can apply them in interesting ways here.
Well, I just think that's a part of kind of ongoing education. And I think especially for jobs or positions that there's no formal training for, and anyone kind of doing anything entrepreneurial, I think kind of the basis of kind of entrepreneurialism or kind of this culture that we have at the moment is kind of doing things that you might not be qualified to do, really, you know? So you have to look to other people and kind of figure out kind of what you're doing. And even when I kind of talk to artists and talk about folios and other things, I always kind of say, well, you know, it's always helpful to have an example of like something aspirational, kind of where you want to be. Otherwise, you know, I don't know. I find it, for me personally,
a guiding light of some sort.
Well, yeah, it's like, it's hard to kind of like, it's hard to self-generate like a direction for yourself, either professionally or personally. Like I always kind of find like that's like, I'm inspired by kind of other people or other kind of businesses, and I kind of want to emulate them. And I think you do those things or find out what they are. And then eventually you find out where your own kind of barriers are. And then that's where you kind of get creative in terms of saying, okay, I like the end result of this, but I'm not an architect, so I can't do it like this. So I'm going to take something else from somewhere else and kind of put it together. And then you synthesize kind of something new. And so I think that's kind of where some of these like more kind of quirky things kind of, I can't believe I've said quirky twice.
I know,
actually my least
quirky.
Favorite word.
Yep.
I guess more idiosyncratic there practices kind of have come from. But yeah, I don't think they can be replicated. I think it's great to kind of look at an outcome and figure out kind of where you want to go and figure out where you are. And then you find your own individual way.
Couldn't agree more. I think as well, you hit the nail on the head when you pulled out that part of the article where it's about shifting your mental space, sort of shocking your body into sort of,
yeah,
which I think that's where your reset showers come in. And that's where a lot of the things in this sort of thing. And so it's about like what works for you and doing that. For me, it sounds a little bit like, and Jeremy, you would know this, but I move all over like I tend to sit in like 70 different positions.
I do the same thing.
And on the couch, even when I'm just on the one couch, I'm like, I'm lying down and I've got my legs up against the wall and then I've got like one leg hanging off there and when I've got my legs under the dog and then I'm sort of like on my stomach and I just like, that also tends to be a like, I'm bored with the task I'm doing kind of move because I can sit in one spot for hours if I'm really invested in something.
But I think it also breaks things down into smaller tasks.
Yes.
Like I've found that since I've had the studio, on days that I know that I need to do big chunks of writing or I have some difficult emails to write, I stay home and work because I actually find that I can write better when I'm laying in this like semi slump position on my bed.
I'm exactly the same. I often, get so much better writing done from my bed, from my couch, whatever, than I do when I'm in the office around other people. Like I really struggle and I do a lot of work, writing work with Jeremy and for the company. And I do end up spending a lot of time working at home because it just, my brain, I need my own space, I find, and my own things. And it just like, for some reason, that's where that sort of creativity works. But that's the same thing. And it's finding that thing that is your own personal jam.
I do have this one trick that I use though, and I've been using it for about 5 years, I reckon now. Every day for about a year, I started the day by sitting down at my desk with a hot drink and I would play an Aphex Twin song, XTAL, and it's on the Select Ambient Works. No, what is it? 89 to 91 or something. Mm. But because I listened to it every single day, my brain was kind of trained into thinking that, okay, this is the start of the day. Like you have to be productive now. So now whenever I'm in a really tricky spot or I'm losing focus, I can hit play on iTunes and sit down and, you know, it gets to halfway through the song and I'm already in the flow state. And then I'll come to like when I've done my difficult bit of writing or whatever and it's already been, I don't know, three songs or something.
It's
and
like
I've
Bianca
just
listened to that
out.
One Strokes album on repeat while she worked 4 years. I think she still does it. It's crazy. And I personally was like, I don't know how that doesn't drive you crazy, but it was just like her flow state, her work music, you know?
Yeah.
Same thing on repeat.
Yeah, it's a comfort to it.
Good stuff, guys.
Anything particular that you do, Laura?
I am bad at trying out this. Like I'm one of those people that will just, unlike you, who's like, I'm going to find the most efficient, perfect way to, I just kind of sit through things and sort it out. So I'm probably not using all the sort of hacks and things that I could be. But no, I need to move. That's just my thing. I need to move. And no matter what it is, I have to be able to get up and sit down and, I don't know, just kind of change positions. And
we tried that with kind of walking meetings. And that's something that's kind of a bit of a hack, kind of hack thing. So that kind of has worked really well for us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Although part of the idea of the walking meeting as well was like, your meetings will be shorter because you're not just sitting, you know, in this room, blah, blah, blah. But I think our last one went for an hour and a half. I had really bad chafing at the end.
Wait, where do you walk though? Just around the
literally around the block.
Ah, okay.
Multiple times.
It's kind of like, except like when you're passing people by and having a very sensitive conversation, all of a sudden you got to kind of ramble on a point like that, like sounds really awkward.
But it's better than sitting in a cafe or something for the whole time and you've got like some first date next to you. Anyway, moving on.
Also, who would have thought that in another, you know, in the caffeine piece here that linked to an Australian study that as few as 5 cups of coffee can potentially lead to psychotic symptoms there. So there you go. That's something new that I learned.
Psychotic.
Yeah, explains a lot. Laura, thank you very much for that link. We will move on from there. So my link for the week comes off the back of what seems to be millions of new product announcements from the annual CES, also known as the Consumer Electronics Show. This is an insane annual event where all the major tech companies tease out upcoming tech or product releases. There's also some incredibly weird stuff that gets released every year. There's, if you look up CES weird, you'll find a bunch of it. This year, there was an RGB space toilet, a smart bidet, camera probes to take pictures of babies' inner ears, a smartphone app that can track your sperm count, Lamborghini massage chairs, lots of interesting stuff. But I'm going to be focusing on one manufacturer in particular, which is quite close to my heart, and that is HTC, a company that I actually don't know what it stands for. I should find that out. But they've They are the company which has recently taken the lead along with Facebook's Oculus with regard to developing the hardware that VR software runs on. And that's been something really big that we've been experimenting with here. And we've been kind of have our own HTC kind of setup. And, you know, hardware has always been one of the biggest roadblocks to mainstream adoption of VR. So at the moment, you need a really powerful PC. There's no Mac support right now. There's the new iMac Pro, which is supposed to run VR, but it's also prohibitively expensive. You need kind of these lighthouses, which are kind of tracking devices.
Which are these big, tall,
things have to go on kind of like, have to be put on kind of tripods. You need a headset. You need two handsets. You need like a hub that kind of connects it all together. There's wires between everything. It's really
problematic. And the game you're playing might need other sort of bits of.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So look, Oculus actually announced their newest headset last year. They haven't launched it, but it's called the Oculus Quest, which is the first VR headset, which is going to be a standalone unit, which is just one headset and controllers and completely wireless and doesn't need any kind of PC or anything else. It's all kind of on board. And, you know, while that's kind of still a while away, there's kind of this race at the moment between Oculus and HTC. So at CES, HTC just jumped in the fray with two really interesting technologies. So they've announced the Vive Pro Eye. And again, I don't know if it's Vive or Vive, but I always say Vive.
Every time it comes up on the podcast, I say Vive.
I'm just going to say Vive just because.
I'm going to say Vive.
Okay. I don't know. Anyway, we have the Vive Pro Eye and the Vive Cosmos. So the article that I'm linking to here is from Gizmodo, the Australian version, but I think it's the same on both US and Australia. It outlines all the details there. So the Vive Pro Eye adds eye tracking into the current flagship headset, the Vive Pro, which is the one kind of we're running in our own setup. And so I'm just doing a bit of a quote here. So it says, the first benefit results from foveated rendering, which takes advantage of the headset's eye tracker to adjust which parts of a virtual scene get priority when processing graphics. Because the headset knows where you're looking, it can spend a larger share of the computer's performance rendering what you see at the moment while dialing back other images in your peripheral vision. Not only does this reduce the overall graphic requirements needed to run VR, but also allows developers to increase the fidelity of what's in focus. Secondly, by incorporating eye tracking to the headset, many experiences no longer require additional controllers to navigate things like menus or settings. You can simply look at an option and a cursor techno-magically appears as the headset knows what you're thinking, which is insane. Mm-hmm. Actually, IBM has these things called ThinkPads, and one of the features there is like this little red nub in the middle, which was kind of like the mouse. And I always thought as a kid that like all you had to do was look at it, and that's why they were called ThinkPads, because like you looked at the red dot and it moved around, or you put your finger on it.
I was very special.
So the real fun announcement here is the Vive Cosmos, and similar to Oculus's Quest, the new device won't require any external hardware. It'll also run entirely new software called the Vive Reality System. So right now, everything's kind of been tethered to either Oculus's software, if you're running Oculus, or you're working with the Valve Steam ecosystem, which is kind of like a Netflix for games, basically. But yeah, you're kind of tied into these environments. So it's interesting because like a lot of like the early days of iOS, it's still really the Wild West in terms of the software and hardware. However, this release represents what people are calling the second phase of VR development. Obviously, it's not actually kind of the second one. Like VR has been kind of coming along for a long time.
Since like the 60s, they've been experimenting with VR. Yeah.
But like a lot of these larger hurdles are slowly being lowered and everyone's kind of thinking, okay, what is it going to be that's going to make this reach kind of mainstream adoption? So like its cousin tech, augmented reality, we've spoken here about before. I don't know exactly what episode. We'll put a link to that in our show notes. But it's a bit of a race at the moment to see what breakout tech or hardware is going to be the thing that cracks everything open, similar to what the iPhone did for smartphones. So look, here at Jackie Winter, we've been experimenting really deeply with both of these techs. With our latest field guide, we did in collaboration with Platar, they're a local AR company, and you know, we just spent the last kind of few months getting artists in to draw things in Google Blocks and Tilt Brush and put in this kind of VR experience. So that's something we've self-initiated because I think in our industry, you really kind of have to keep up with the tech to ensure it doesn't kind of leave you behind. And more than anything, it's a lot of fun to kind of play with as well. So look, to that end, I thought as we approach this kind of second wave of development, I thought it'd just be good to check in a bit closer to home to see, you know, both from an artist and production side, like where are the actual kind of commercial applications here? Because this is always kind of the big question. We have a kind of a rig that we move around. Last time we brought it to a client, people just thought we were kind of representatives of Google that were there to kind of just, you know, showcase a product. And the real answer is like, we don't know. Like, we don't know where it's going to go. But the only way to kind of find out is just kind of by doing it. So Carla, I want to open up to you first. As an artist, you've had an opportunity to play with our rig during our holiday party. You're doing some interesting things. It was a kind of a small experience, but I'm kind of curious to hear from your perspective. You know, you're someone who, you know, is very physical in your work as well, especially when you look at the environmental work like murals and other things that you kind of do in spaces. You know, where do you think, what's your first kind of, I guess, initial thoughts on where the tech can fit into either your commercial artistic practice or just kind of in commercial artistic practice in general?
I guess I feel like I have to start by kind of prefacing and saying that I'm actually feel like I'm a generally pretty slow adopter to new tech. Like I don't really usually acquire it for no reason at all, or like I I hung on to a Nokia QWERTY keyboard thing until like late 2013. It was pretty crazy. But I feel like I was actually a little bit intimidated by the VR stuff. Also because I feel like a lot of my work, I use analog and I use digital mediums. But even when I'm using digital, it's often in an analog way. Like I'm replicating some textures. A lot things are mostly 2D. I'm not sort of beveling, or it's all pretty rudimentary, I guess.
And so I guess the reason you'd be using those is more for the sake of like clients needing digital files or like being able to do revisions, but you're still trying to kind of make the work that feels
I'm not usually
handmade.
Driven by a drive to make work that doesn't look handmade. I guess when I initially was thinking about VR, I was trying to imagine a way that my work could be applied to it. And I'd have this blocker because I just couldn't visualize what I could make with it because I didn't really know how it worked either. It turns out I underestimated everything about it. It was heaps of fun. And yeah, I got to play with it at the holiday party. And I just was instantly, the immersiveness was just insane. Like you feel like you just dropped into a whole other world. As soon as you put that headset on, you're not even rooted in reality anymore. And I guess so much of my work, like you said, is about either putting work in spaces or creating these spaces that are made up of shapes and lines and color. And so to be given the opportunity to actually create a space and almost be like the little architect or engineer that can create this virtual environment for people to immerse themselves in as well, that feels like a really exciting thing for me. And I guess also I make a lot of work that involves characters and drawing people. And as a kid, I'd always be drawing these characters to kind of make these new versions of people or versions of myself that I could project myself into and like garner these new sense of power or confidence from, right? But I spent so much time imagining how these characters exist in that world that I don't think I could have ever imagined that I could make them exist in the real world or this VR real world
with
dimensions. So I can't help but imagine a version where you can create this character that is almost like a new person that people can step in and interact with. And that really blows my mind.
Well, I imagine a lot of gaming in that space that's exactly the effect that we're going for.
Yeah. I guess when I work, I'm always making this work that is trying to elicit a feeling from people or like trying to change how they feel in a space. But to actually completely engineer the space for someone to exist in, that's like a whole other level of awesomeness.
Laura, I'm going to pose a similar question to you. You know, you're someone who's very engaged technically. Your thoughts on the 5G network last week, for example, were really thoughtful and raised some interesting questions. So obviously we're all asking questions now and hoping someone comes up with the answers. So, you know, what's your current kind of status report on VR, specifically within a commercial context?
Good news. I've got all the answers. No,
yes.
I have none. But yeah, you're right, Jeremy. It is a totally fascinating time being in that sort of second wave of development where we've moved past that initial breakthrough of tech like Rift and the Vive stuff that sort of finally passed the proof of concept test and properly showed us just how powerful and immersive VR is, even if the sort of genre as a whole wasn't quite ready for everyone. And as the writer here puts it, this second phase we're in now is largely the process of refining VR tech whilst also adding new features and abilities that expand upon what VR can do, with eye tracking and freestanding units being this latest piece of the puzzle. And yes, of course, as you've acknowledged and I have acknowledged, we've all acknowledged, this second wave is still just a stepping stone on that sort of path towards full adoption. But there is no doubt whatsoever at all anymore that it is coming. I think that's been the thing. There's sort of been this wavering of like, yeah, it's amazing, but will it actually grow? And I think personally, anyway, I think absolutely without a doubt, it is growing. And I just think that there's no question this sector is going to be worth billions in a few years. I mean, there's already billions of dollars of revenue predicted in the AR and VR industries in just Australia alone. So it's an exciting time, and not just for tech nerds like you and I. It's, for everyone, as these things are finally sort of moving closer to the general market. Although I did read many a disappointed review of CES this year. Apparently it was not that groundbreaking for once. I don't know. We'll talk about that offline later. Anyway, one thing that has been obvious, and especially in hearing from you, Colour, as well, like is how so many artists have naturally sort of been drawn to it, whether they're early adopters or have sort of fallen into it a bit later, particularly those I think that were already working in 3D gaming or animation, but also many 2D artists, including yourself and many others. I think VR lets you interact with and comprehend scale and depth very naturally, and it gives you that opportunity to actually relate the virtual object to your own body and space. And so it's not surprising that I think that artists are drawn to it. Just one of many, many examples is the amazing and award-winning, that 360-degree VR interactive film and exhibition that Roan, the artist, did recently to a Cannes, New York Film Fest, Next, South by Southwest. And, you know, of course, we've also seen so many galleries, both like major institutions and smaller spaces around the world, exhibiting VR sort of centric shows, and they're really diving into this growing trend and market desire for full immersion. Sotheby's did a really cool thing for one of their auctions a few years ago now, where you could basically wear a VR headset and travel through surrealist masterpieces by Dalí and Magritte, Tableau, and all these things. Like, so yeah, you've got all sorts of stuff coming out as well in the music video space. And then there's companies like Next VR who are doing like full immersive experiences for sporting events like the NBA or WWE and music festivals, where it's not just like sort of investigating an artwork. It's like bringing people into an actual event that they couldn't attend, which is fascinating. And I guess the thing is that this kind of stuff isn't even really novel or unique anymore. They're still exciting, but there are VR experiences popping up everywhere. There is a VR cinema now here in Collingwood, like just around the corner on Johnson Street. And they're also screening the Roan piece there at the moment, if anyone wants to see it. I was reading recently as well about a company called VR All Art, of which there are many other similar ones out there, who describe themselves as an infinite virtual gallery space, where as an artist, gallerist, or curator, you can exhibit works without thinking about physical, spatial, or time boundaries in any virtual room you can think of. And concepts like this they sort of aim to enable anyone, anywhere, I guess, with access to this hardware is the little sort of caveat there. But anyone, anywhere to explore artworks and artists from different parts of the world. These things are everywhere now. Startup companies, existing art institutions, and individual artists, everyone's taking advantage of it. And I read a great quote from artist Mariam Zakharian. She said, "With VR art, people can visit the world in my head instead of looking at it through a window," which I think really describes the experience and the possibilities really beautifully. And I think the whole thing here, as you were mentioning, Carla, is that idea of full immersion. Like, what's most interesting to a lot of people who are working in this space is that whilst it can provide a very realistic experience, what you do in virtual reality actually kind of bears very little consequence in our real organic world. And so you have this incredibly real, you know, interaction between creator and medium, between medium and viewer. And so the platform allows for these really vivid experiences where people can experiment and play freely within it without actually affecting the real world in any significant way, which opens up the opportunity for some like totally insane stuff. And yeah, as we've talked about before, VR, it's entirely unique in its ability to really center someone in an experience without distractions. That's the big thing as well, to like make sure that someone's actually focusing on and interacting with your work is like, that's not an opportunity we're often given. And VR really sort of enhances that. And you can really put someone in someone else's shoes, whatever shoes you want to put them in. And all sorts of people are using that to tell incredible stories. We talked about a bunch on another episode. One I wanted to highlight was last year after the Grenfell fires in London, Channel 4 released a really cool VR documentary that explored the lives of the people who lived in the towers before the tragedy. And I think just something like this is so fascinating in terms of like digitally, but also in a very real sense, physically placing people in a certain perspective and the opportunities for that to be used not just in entertainment and art, but in legal, educational, healthcare, retail applications, and of course, gaming, boundless. I saw an interesting project recently in November last year. Australian government here invested $726,000 in a project that uses virtual reality to check the driving skills of senior Australians.
Whoa.
Yes, Jeremy, maybe you can take advantage of it. So this tech is being taken seriously and it's being experimented with across all sorts of sectors.
Sorry, I was just kind of looking through Slack to find the time where we're discussing this article and I think we'll post a link to this. All right, cool. Sounds good. I don't have a lot to add here, unfortunately, but I'm excited to hear your thoughts. You had a lot to add there. That was some pretty good stuff.
I always tell you, I don't know what I'm going to say about this, Jerry. And then you know me, I get deep. I go deep, especially when we're talking about stuff like this, because it genuinely excites me. I want to say, don't mistake my excitement, my enthusiasm for any sort of confidence that the technologies that we have right now, or even that they've been talking about at CES, anything we'll have in the sort of foreseeable future, are going to be what really takes off. I think it would be foolish to think that they are significant, but they're small steps forward. I don't think that this is the hardware that's going to revamp the entire industry. I think it's definitely a step towards it. But I do think there are still issues in terms of working with human physiology and breaking those barriers of movement, vision, cognition, etc.
Yeah,
to resolve those before it's going to be, you know, fully mainstream or in the home.
Definitely, definitely. I guess my reaction's a bit more straightforward and kind of simple. And it's kind of like when you talk about evolution, some of them are really subtle, but the technological advances behind them are actually really interesting. So it's like, for example, the iPad and the pencil, the movement between the different iPads and the two different pencils and the kind of tech that goes there under kind of the surface in terms of one of the big things they don't really talk about is like reducing the latency. So for example, latency is like the time that you put the pencil to the iPad and the time that kind of something registers.
We talked about latency in terms of 5G and that sort of response time. time, basically.
And so I kind of think, you know, this, like the more kind of cords you kind of cut, the more kind of...
And the time you cut down.
And yeah. Exactly. The more you kind of reduce, I'm putting latency in air quotes here, in kind of VR. And kind of, I guess the thing that's most interesting for me is that I actually don't think that VR is going to be the platform that's going to be the one that kind of leads first. I kind of think everyone's kind of has their... is placing their bets on AR, and I kind of feel that's kind of happening as well. So especially you look at stuff like, you know, Snapchat or Google Glass, like all the stuff that, or Snapchat glasses, I mean, and you know, all the stuff that was kind of really kind of early, but the whole kind of idea that, you know, you might have a contact lens or a kind of a wearable that will give you another layer to reality. I mean, we already have it with our phones. We've spoken about how, you know, the phones and stories are kind of like this window, you know, between us and our experience. So it only makes sense that that's kind of, you know, it's moved to the Apple Watch.
Well, and in terms of adoption as well, like, I mean, it makes sense that people will welcome in something that blends with their current life more than something that shuts that out like VR does.
Yeah. Now here's the interesting thing though, I think that we haven't talked about much, is that I think artists though need to know how to create work in this medium, because that's the most interesting thing about VR. And that's kind of why I'm so passionate about it, is because it's going to, right now it's a bit of a negative. Like every time someone does a piece in Google Blocks or in Tilt Brush, it looks like a Tilt Brush or Google piece. And it's like, just like when people were painting on computers, everything that like...
Yeah, it looked like Microsoft Paint.
Like Microsoft Paint. So it's like a lot of the time the aesthetic is really kind of tied to the...
But that's not going to be the case forever.
No, it's not going to be the case forever. However, I think the artists who like take advantage of the platform and actually kind of start using it, similar to how when the Mac came out, like what that did for graphic design and kind of typography. And a lot of that stuff is kind of still fresh in some ways, like kind of looking back then. So I see huge opportunities for artists who are willing to kind of engage with the platform. And I wish I had the name of the artist right now. I actually found them on Australian Design Radio. She's an artist that was out here for Adobe Max, who is kind of a Tilt Brush artist, you know?
There's lots now. There's heaps, and they're doing some like pretty moving, incredible stuff.
So I think, you know, the things that Carla was talking about in terms of creating these environments. So it's like, yes, a lot of that, you know, will happen kind of offline and kind of in normal kind of platforms. But I think these environments are going to be made, and people are going to need to create pieces and create these works that are have to go in those experiences. So I think
completely agree. I think like undoubtedly in many ways, and not just in VR, I think in the world, in everything that we do, we are going through a sort of like, I guess this like immersive reality revolution. Like people want these fully immersive experiences that combine all of the tech, all of the stuff that we have, all of the benefits, and you know, into one sort of experience that is a constant with them all the time. And governments around the world are including big financial commitments into their budgets to developing VR, AR, and other sorts of tech. Even right here in Australia, the government here pledged enormous amounts of money with Screen Australia and CSIRO to developing these areas. So
yeah, you were talking about access before, and how, you know, obviously that's a barrier. You need this software to access these experiences. It makes me think about libraries and the new way that libraries are being designed now to be so much more, I don't know, they're like a big contemplative hub now. There's not just books. You can go there and, you know, there's Mac Labs to be doing design stuff.
We talked about libraries once on the show. Yeah. Big fans of libraries, and they have like music recording studios. Yeah.
Do you remember when CD-ROMs first came out? I don't know if this is kind of around the time, and it's like there was Encarta, Microsoft Encarta. It was like the first kind of, and it's like, but like the only place you go to was the library to kind of see it. Like, that was kind of so quaint. And like, yeah, like, you know, maybe there is kind of a parallel.
But
here,
like those prohibitive costs of VR sort of hardware are slowly but surely going down. Like it's no longer just this sort of fancy fad that's only open to those with tons of cash and heaps of tech experience to be able to use it. Like it is definitely going down. And whether VR is the thing that lasts or not, you know, whether it's something that sort of this follows onto, whether it's more focused on AR or mixed reality, a mix of AR and VR. I mean, like I just do think that if you look under the surface, or if you're anyone who's sort of even slightly in the know, there are people behind the scenes, creators everywhere are hard at work refining the craft so that when these developments do eventually drive consumer interest, there will be a heap of top-notch content available and a heap of top-notch creators able to do it. So I think if you are someone working in any space, not just the arts, but architecture, design, healthcare, education, retail, etc., and if you do have an interest in these technologies, then it's worth looking into them. It's worth starting now and developing your skills and knowledge here, and even with developing content to prepare you for when these things actually do eventually hit prime time.
Absolutely. Well, look, we're going to keep pressing on with our own experimentations. I'm hoping that it's going to be something we're going to be able to let other people kind of experience as well, if you have your own rig, but we'll, you know, keep an eye out on our newsletter for that. And hopefully we'll check in maybe in a couple months' time and talk about the third wave of development and see where that is at.
Couple of months, wishful thinking, Jeremy.
Well, you know, it kind of, the time frame cuts down. It gets shorter and shorter between each phase. So, you know, who knows? But thank you both for your input, and we'll move on from there. Carla, our final link for the week. This is something kind of new for us, like a whole kind of course. Before we kind of dive into this, something I like to ask everybody who comes on the show, tell us a bit more about your internet hygiene. Where do you kind of find your links? What is your kind of internet reading habits like? And where did you find this one? And tell us a bit more about it.
My internet reading habits are a bit all over the place. I don't really have RSS or Feedly or anything like that. I wish that I sort of had the diligence to set it up. I don't know why. I just keep putting it off.
But I have it and I don't use it.
Yeah, well, I do a lot of clicking around, I guess. There's a few definite news sites and blogs that I go back to every week and I catch up and do my reading. But then there's a bunch of Twitter accounts, you know, particular writers, especially Australian writers, that I check up on, see what they've been sharing, and skipping around Facebook. Mm. I even look at Tumblr a little bit still. Like that people are still writing and sharing things there. Yeah, it's a bit all over the place. And as a result, I feel like it's broad.
I keep talking to artists and they're still into the Tumblr. For me, like I didn't realize it was still a thing, but it's out there.
Yeah.
I'm still writing my live journal, so anything
can happen. GSCs.
Yes.
And so where did you find out about this?
So I listened to one of the most recent Design Matters podcasts.
I listened to it as well.
With Debbie Millman. And yeah, Jocelyn K. Gly was her guest. And I guess she was on there, I don't know, were you guys familiar with Jocelyn K. Gly?
Yeah, we've talked about her every now and then. We've had a few articles from her, but also her podcast, Harry Slowly, we've come across a few times. And
yeah, I didn't realize she's done lots of things, but yeah, really kind of was instrumental in kind of the work at 99U and Behance. And
yes, that she's come up a few times on the show.
So she was the founding editor of 99U, and she also writes books about creativity and productivity, and she's the host of Harry Slowly, and I only recently just got onto Harry Slowly as well. Yeah, Jocelyn was on Design Matters and she was talking a lot about how tech has pulled us into working in ways that are unhealthy and unsustainable, and how common, I guess, as a result, burnout is in a lot of people, not just creatives, but everyone working today.
And this was a pretty hot button issue from last week as well, like with this BuzzFeed article that was going around that kind of, you know, inspired a million
different
kind of
think pieces. I never finished. It took too long. I got burned out.
Was that the one about millennials?
Burnout. Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It was huge.
So obviously this is something that kind of like, you know, she spoke about this kind of course that she's running and it's something that interests you and you kind of checked it out. So yeah, what kind of drew you to it? Is this something that you resonate with?
Yeah, I guess I just feel like it's something that I feel like I've been talking a lot about with a lot of my peers and especially people who are freelancing. And I guess listening to her story about her own burnout story makes me think about, I don't know, my own version or other people's versions that I've sort of heard. But the course is called Reset. Essentially, after her own experiences with burnout, she was inspired to develop it. And she calls it a cosmic tune-up, kind of playfully.
I'm into it.
But essentially, it's a four-week course and it consists of a series of videos, talks, reset rituals, meditations, and a live Q&A session each week to kind of complement whatever learning you're doing. The main focus for the course is on teaching ways to work with intention to supposedly regain power in your workday. And I guess it's cheesy, but I do become interested in this kind of self-help exploration.
I don't think it's cheesy. I think it's completely valid.
Yeah, yeah. Like I got really into Brené Brown last year and I feel like she talks about shame and vulnerability in a way that has actually changed the way that I probably move throughout the world every day. So,
I'm
positive
story. I recondoed my whole fucking room the other day. Just tell me about it.
Yeah. I guess when I started doing some reading after she'd kind of explained all of what her course was about, I was really taken by the way that she talks about how we treat our minds and bodies like computers now, and that we kind of find ourselves plowing through days or weeks worth of work in the same way a computer would. And she talks a lot about how the digital space assumes infinite capacity. You know, we're always available via email, Slack, text, Instagram, Twitter. Everyone can get a hold of us, but that doesn't actually work for humans because we have these really hard limits to our time and energy and efficiency. And she kind of joked, you know, I'm not going to email you, Lara, and say, oh, I need this from you. And, you know, I'm not going to reply saying, I can't do that for you right now. I'm not available to talk. You know, it's just not, it's not the way that, that
works. I wouldn't mind trying it.
But in her talk on Design Matters, she says that creative people can actually be more susceptible to being sucked into tech and using technology, I guess leaning on it a little bit as a crutch. And she says that one of the things that make us creative is this idea of having a leaky attention or leaky brain, which means that we're quite open and permeable and we're really receptive to all of the things that are going on around us.
Shiny
and that's
thing.
What makes us exactly. But we notice these things and we turn it into inspiration, then we make work. But also it lends us to being a lot more susceptible to being pulled into these more negative and distracting parts of our tech. And yeah, like I said earlier, I'd say I've had my own experiences with burnout, but it's something that I've only really realized what was happening in retrospect. Like when I really zoom out, I can see what behaviors I'm susceptible to and how it affects my life. And for me, probably the main ones are boundaries with my time and tech. And so I guess I started wondering if this course would be something that would help me.
Well, I like how you were telling us about offline.
Have you signed up?
No, because again, I'm just not sure. It made me think about a lot of things that I talk about with my peers, and I'm sure that you would talk about with this with the rest of your artists, or you talk about it in the office a lot, but it's also the freelance lifestyle. You know, a big part of this rest on technology that we have is this collapse of this hierarchy, the traditional working hierarchy. And so when you're working for yourself and when you really love what you do and you want to do it all the time, it also comes with the onus of the self-management of like your workloads and the clients and your finances, and you have to create the boundaries. All of that onus is on you, but you know, the skills don't come naturally and we don't learn them from anywhere. So I guess a big example of this for me is that I struggle with setting boundaries, and it's driven by the paranoia of the work just stopping because I work for myself, but also I have this hunger to be challenged all the time, and you know, it's really hard to say no to things. So then I turn into a yes man.
And admittedly, like we all know working in this industry that it can be like that with artists. You can have, you know, when it rains, it pours, and then you've got these droughts for ages of no work, you know, unfortunately. And so you do have to be thinking about your money, your cash flow in a sense.
The thing that happens is when I have a lot of projects on, I don't pare it back. It actually completely flips. And I've found this talking with a lot of my peers that you can actually just end up getting completely consumed by it, and you get obsessed by chasing your own productivity. And it gets to the point where there's so many projects on that you're just completely wrapped up in it. Things like eating healthily and recreational play stuff kind of goes out the window, and you're so intent on finishing each project and moving on to the next that you're no longer present enough to appreciate the work that you've done.
Or do your best work, I imagine.
Yeah, exactly. And then when you've trained yourself to work at this really insane pace, it becomes a new normal. And so it becomes harder to be reasonable about how much work you've done. And it becomes this unsustainable, I guess, schedule that you set out for yourself, and these unreasonable expectations that are really hard to pare back once they've been set in place for a few weeks.
I have to say, I'm always so happy when the recording room becomes the therapy room again.
It's my favorite. It's totally turned into therapy. I could keep talking about it forever.
But it's very real stuff that I think most, if not all freelancers, would deal with in some way, in their own ways.
Yeah, but I guess I know that I'm productive and that I'm disciplined and I'm still having creative ideas, but when I zoom out, I can see the unsustainable pattern. And I think that we all take it as part and parcel of the job of being a freelancer or being a creative. There's a lot of this like pep talk stuff that flies around on the internet, a lot of self-help, social media, like we're never doing enough. You can always be doing it better. And I just wonder,
slave-driving bosses who just won't let you rest. Oh, am I right?
but we're all just connected to it constantly. And like, I just wonder if maybe this course could be really valuable to people like freelancers, you know, giving them a tool to take control of their weeks a bit better and rein in the leaky brain. But I guess I was wondering if either of you ever feel this pressure. Like, do you ever seek out self-help stuff like this?
I like the occasional self-help, and Lord knows I need it. It is interesting, I think, to see courses like this popping up, because generally most courses that we see in any sort of creative space or any industry are kind of the opposite. Like they're all about maximizing creativity or productivity. So it's like, how can you do more and be better at it all the time? So it's kind of interesting to see something like this that's aiming to sort of recalibrate the way that we work and push back against toxic habits. And I enjoyed actually reading through the course outline. They've got a good course outline there of what would be taught and studied each week. And it seems like a really well-balanced curriculum sort of between learning to set boundaries whilst also sort of making the most of the time that you do have and using it really effectively. So I guess in a way it is sort of about productivity, but hopefully in a healthy sort of sustainable way, which I like. And I think at $239, it's a fairly affordable course, and it is a pretty shrewd business decision from Jocelyn in terms of like taking this stuff that people are clearly aching for and turning it into a fairly passive income.
Well, that was sort of how I felt about it as well. You know, she's spending all this time saying we're too preoccupied with being more productive, and there's all this self-help stuff that's making us better manage our time and like be more creative thinkers.
And we're so obsessed with reading about productivity.
And then it's like, and by the way,
here's this thing.
Here's
about
how
to
you
be,
can do it with my advice.
But I think that, I mean, I don't know. I don't feel necessarily like negatively or positively about it, because I don't know enough about the course itself or her intentions or whatever. But I think there's like definitely valid reasons for this to exist. And I think there's absolutely nothing wrong with people making a passive income if it's something that, if it's a product that people actually want and actually helps people, hell yeah. I mean, that's education in its like, its foundations of education is like reusing materials and whatever. Yeah. I've never done a course like this. And in fact, I don't think I've ever come across a course like this. I've done other personal development courses before, of course, but it's always been more focused on classic skills that are related specifically to my line of work.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'd be interested to look further into it. I really like Jocelyn. I like the Hurry Slowly podcast, which as well is all about pacing yourself and being more productive, creative, resilient, whatever, in a healthy way. I can see Jeremy smirking in the corner though. So yeah, I want to know.
Oh, no, no. I mean, I think, yeah, like it's so hard. I don't want to cast judgment on it because like I also listened to the podcast and I really kind of enjoyed, you know, what she had to kind of say. I thought it was interesting as well that a lot of this came out of her journeys in with a shaman for some ayahuasca that she was kind of doing. So like, you know, it's called a cosmic tune-up for your work day. But like, I mean, but I never want to go kind of like too kind of spiritual or kind of like mystic here on this podcast. But I do think there is kind of like some kind of crossover here. And I do kind of feel that like a lot of these things are kind of really things that kind of, well, like what kind of religion and spirituality have been doing for people for kind of thousands of years. And they're kind of being repackaged kind of in this different way, which I kind of find like is a bit dangerous as well because of actually some of the things that we were talking about.
Yeah, but so is religion and spirituality. They can be just as dangerous.
Oh yeah, I'm not saying it's not dangerous at all. But it's interesting. It's interesting that this comes out actually from the first link that we were talking about in terms of again like kind of all these kind of self hacks and kind of whether or not like, you know, programs like this like will have kind of like a net benefit or if they are just kind of adding, you know, to the whole kind of cult of self improvement as well.
It's so noisy out there. Like it's so noisy.
It is. But one thing I would like I refrain from doing, I guess, is like, I think there's with a lot of things, whether it's something like this, you know, how to be calm or how to manage your time or whether it's quitting smoking or quitting drinking or if it's getting healthy. I think there's like some stigma around like the idea that you should be able to figure it out yourself and you should be able to do it. Like it should be natural. It should be common sense that like, of course you just stop eating chocolate or of course you go for a run each day or of course you are strict about your time boundaries, whatever, and you should be able to read a book and be fine or whatever, just do it yourself. And perhaps it's not that. Perhaps you do need to be forced to sit down and go through course materials and really have someone explain it to you for it to actually stick in your head and to put it into practice. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And in terms of like the price point that it's at, I don't think it's like a crazy rort like some of the conferences or some of the courses that sit in this kind of self-help area can be. So like, I don't know, I look at it like fairly positively, even if I'm not sure if it's something that I'll do or not.
What would stop you from doing something like this?
I guess I'm just really critical of some of these kind of self-help and self-care stuff that's floating around. Like I feel like I jump around and read a bunch of it. Maybe I struggle with applying, like we were saying earlier, I'm quite lazy with applying other people's, I guess, tips or knowledge to my work week or my lifestyle, because I feel like I have this, I've worked to this point of having like a...
Well, figuring it out yourself.
I don't have a strict schedule that I work to each week because every week is different. But I do feel like there are things that I do to make it smooth and productive and bearable and to stay creative amongst it all as well. And I almost feel like I don't believe in my ability to take it on and for it to actually change, because there is so much noise happening and we all like almost pep each other up to be, we all tell each other that we're so privileged to have these jobs, but we also, it takes a lot of work to do this work. And I sort of feel like they're going to be tough times and you are going to burn out a little bit, and it's just almost, we can learn from these articles and these books and maybe courses and stuff, but at the end of the day it's always going to be a little bit,
if anything,
intangible,
maybe
in a way.
Something, and Jeremy, I really am not actually meaning this as a hint to you, you're very good, but perhaps it's something that's more than for freelancers, maybe for like managers or business owners to learn to understand the time that their employees also need and that they're might be valuable in terms of then how they run their business and how that, because it's probably the company and the management that probably has the biggest impact on how someone can regulate their time, not the actual employee themselves. You know, it's the amount of work they have coming in. Yeah. So it's like when people at the top understand how they can design a company and design processes and resources to better, you know, allow for better sort of work-life health balance, whatever, then that might be useful. It's funny because like we always talk about how like production is tricky, especially when it comes to these kinds of tips and techniques and courses and hacks, because it's such a reactive job.
Well, you could just say that about any job. And like everything that you're saying, it's like, you know, you could go to the top, but a lot of these issues are kind of systemic in a way, because it's like everyone's always reacting to someone else's needs, to someone else's needs, to someone else's.
But I think we could, like, production, and there are lots of other jobs that fall into space. Production is particularly particularly reactive, and particularly you're on call, like, 24/7.
Look, I think the bottom line with a lot of this is that, like, a lot of the work that artists and producers do, it's like part of this growing knowledge sector. Like, you know, we're all knowledge workers kind of in this way, or I guess artists are kind of arts workers in that way, but, you know, really relying on their kind of, on their knowledge and on their kind of brain in that way. And I think if I was to kind of count up all the links that we've kind of done in the past, I don't know how many, well, this is our 67th episode now, I would say that the overwhelming theme of things, like, is kind of mental health and kind of burnout and kind of attention and all these kind of things. And I
what
think,
does that tell us?
Well, it tells us that, like, you know, it tells us exactly what this course is kind of saying, is that, and like all the other things that we're saying is, like, I think that we're reaching the boundaries of how far we can push ourselves, you know, physically.
Just reaching the boundaries, you can see, maybe not in practice, but in what people are talking about on the internet and in books and courses and whatever, that it's not just reaching the boundaries, it's literally like rebounding off those. Like, we've gone further, push ourselves. And now people have sort of hit that wall and gone back, and it's like, no, less phones, less internet, less work, less email. And everyone's kind of trying to, like, sort of tread back and fix the mistakes that we sort of have made.
Yeah, I guess I also wanted to ask you guys, I feel like everyone's obsessed with tech, right? And none of us like to really admit it, but we are obsessed with our phones, and social media is really tricky, especially when it's all wrapped up with work. You know, you're really clocked on, but also you're clocked on for the dopamine hit.
Yep.
You know, oh, yeah. We all love the dopamine
hit.
Hell yeah. But
gotta get them likes.
In the last few months, I've been trying to take steps, like using an analog alarm clock in the morning to wake up, so I'm not rolling over, smashing off my alarm clock, and then checking my email instantly. Or like trying to use the screen time tracker, but I always, you know, blow it out every single day. I was wondering if you guys ever feel the need to do like a purge or one of those trendy digi detoxes.
I gotta be honest, not hugely, because I am. For all its faults, I'm happy with my usage. I'm happy with how I use my phone and the internet. There are little things that I could curb, but I feel like I'm actually not the worst offender. Like, I'm not terrible. But that said, like, the times that I have done a bit of a detox, like, not necessarily on purpose, but, you know, like, I have felt wonderful. Like, just over these Christmas holidays, for the first time, like, on holidays, obviously, my usage drops down a bit. But the first time ever, I kind of just didn't open my email or Slack, like, at all for 2 weeks. And not even on purpose, I just forgot about it. I was just, like, so into holiday mode that I've completely just was like, nah.
Awesome.
And I have to say that at the end of those 2 weeks, I felt so uncharacteristically rested and peaceful, and it was awesome. So there might be something to be said for switching off and engaging with the real world once in a while.
Who would have thunk it? Well, look, there's lots of points that this raises. If anyone has gone and, or, you know, goes and does the course, we'd love to hear from you. Drop us a line at podcast@jackiewinter.com. Tell us about your experience, and yeah, we'll look into this further. And I'm sure, you know, like we said, it's a frequently recurring theme that lots of people are trying to solve and kind of add into the mix. So I look forward to teasing it out more in the months ahead. Carla, thank you so much for bringing the link in. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Before we wrap, it is time for our favorite segment, the brilliantly named Thumbs Up, Thumbs Down, Shaka, the time we dedicate each week to get the good, the bad, and the totally radical off of our chest. Lara, what do you got for us this week? Thumbs up, thumbs down, Shaka? Hit
back
us.
Back to thumbs down.
What do you got?
I've been very positive the last few months, but I'm back to thumbs down. I have a thumbs down to thieves, thievery, burglars, swindlers,
thieving
whatever
thieves.
You call them, these rat bastards. Someone thieved my Mikey. Mikey is, for anyone not in Melbourne and doesn't have to suffer through it, is your little card that you get to use the public transport system. And you load it up with money and you tap it on when you get into the station or the bus stop or whatever, and you tap it off again, and it takes money out of your card and it lets you use the train, the bus, the tram, whatever else. So someone stole my Mikey, and I didn't realize that my Mikey was linked to my bank account. And so since September last year, it's now 15th of Jan, since September last year, I've been paying for someone's fucking public transport. And of course, I don't look at my bank statements or anything, and I probably should. But I went on today to register my new Mikey. And yeah, I realized someone, and it's so weird because you can see where they've been traveling. Like, you can see what stops they've gotten on off at. So someone in the sort of Bentley Holmes Glen region, I'm fucking coming for you.
Ripped.
Carla, what do you got for us? Anything you'd like to endorse or disendorse?
Yeah, I've got a softly rockin' shaka for finger limes this season.
Oh, yes.
Finger limes?
Yeah. Have you not had a finger lime before?
I'm just imagining some kind of disease where your fingers turn into limes.
They're a native Australian citrus and they're probably the size of your finger, hence the name finger lime. Mm-hmm. And actually, as the riper they get, the more like a rotting finger they look. So they're a little bit creepy. Mm. But they're nicknamed citrus caviar. Because you slice them open, you pop out these delicious little bursts of citrus, refreshing flavor, they are just the best. I'll be having some.
Someone put finger lime in my gin and tonic recently,
and it was so good,
mind blowing.
That's been my knockoff drink this week.
This is amazing. Oh. I can't believe it.
Let's go get some now.
This is crazy. It's a whole new fruit I've never seen. It's like when I learned about mangosteen.
Have you Googled
it? Yeah, but you know what?
Mangosteen is great.
So they're really popular, or they're popularly grown in Queensland and New South Wales. It's quite difficult to grow them here, but my mum has been hooking me up.
This is crazy.
Sending them to you.
This is the craziest fruit I've ever seen.
Fruit across state borders.
I will not make a comment on that.
We got 5 kilos of cherries in the mail. Thanks, Dan Gray, by the way.
Thanks, Dan Gray. That was Cheers damn season. Good.
Well, I will round things out with a thumbs up for myself this week, which is fucking school holiday traffic, which is the absence of traffic during school holidays. Hey. Oh my God. It's like for 1 month every year, you get a beautiful glimpse of like, you know, what it could be like if like, I don't know, things were different. And like,
that was so profound.
It's so weird getting to things kind of on time without having to like to allow like for twice the amount of time. It's just like,
and then maybe accidentally getting there early.
It's like such. This is the thing that was going to completely lulls you into this false sense of security, and then it kind of people start slowly coming back, and it's like boiling a lobster. Like all of a sudden, like you realize you're back in the shit for another year. But for the moment, it's a thumbs up. I'm going to ride it.
But does that also mean the kids are at home 24/7?
Oh, well, my kids aren't...
They're not school-aged yet, anyway. They're always home 24/7.
Yeah. Carla, before we head out for the day, where can people find out more about you on the internet?
You can go to my website. That's thepaperbeast.com.au, overhanging old moniker there. And on Instagram, I'm Carla_McRae.
And that's MC.
That's MC.
R-A-E.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much. I think that'll do us for now. I'm Jeremy Wartzman, she is Laura Chan Baker, and this has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Our theme music is by totally unrelated to our company, Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. If you want more JWGYTB, archives of all of our shows and links we've covered can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. To receive all the links we talk about on the show each week in one neat little package, you can sign up to our podcast-specific newsletter, which is at jwg.is/newslettering. Again, jwg.is/newslettering. It's our brand new newsletter combined with our main Jackie Winter newsletter.
And our brand new word that we invented.
And our brand new word, newslettering.
Newslettering.
Yeah, I know. I love it.
Into it.
You can find us mostly on Instagram at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y in Winter Like the Season. And hit us up with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. If you like what you hear, give us a rating on iTunes. It really helps boost the show and get more people onto it, and that makes us more motivated to do it. And remember that this is an enhanced podcast. If you listen to this using Pocket Cast, Overcast, Castro, or Apple Podcasts, you'll be able to see the links to the articles we're talking about, as well as other visual content as we rabbit on. And if you work for an ad agency or design studio or interested in our live extended version of the show called Open Tabs, or maybe to get a tour of our new VR experience, be sure to check out opentabs.rodeo for more info. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Bye bye. Clara, I mean, fuck Clara, sorry. A bit dyslexic. The hotbox has fully gotten to my head when we passed the hour mark.
Start that again, Jerry, please.